All right, good morning. This is Bio 231. And let me turn some lights on back there. And turn some lights off up here. How's that? Does that work well enough? Okay, so we have, this is Bio 231, November 16th. We're going to finish up the heart, move on to vascular system today. And we do have a test scheduled for Wednesday, right? So everybody should be aware of your exam figures and end of chapter study questions and pre-lecture reading assignments and things like that. I haven't checked the pre-lecture reading assignments in quite a while, but I presume that the answer keys are popping up in a reasonable period of time for you, right? So if they're not, make sure you let me know. But that's all been automated, so I think that's working just fine, unless I hear otherwise. So here is a sign-in sheet for today. Make sure you sign sign-in sheet. Hold on to that for just a little while before you pass it around so that people that get in late.
Are all of the
and I put a bunch of lectures online this morning. Okay. And I'll put this lecture online tonight.
Okay.
So... yeah, I had to switch computers out, and that got to be a little bit of a hassle. Changing. No, they weren't up last night. And if you checked any time this morning, you would have found them. Because I put them on like around 5 o'clock this morning. Okay, so we were talking about the heart last time. And you've had a lot of heart in lab, or you've had a practicum on the heart. So I think you're doing pretty good with the heart. So I'll just ask you a few questions. How many chambers does the heart have?
Four.
How many valves does the heart have?
Four.
Okay, so you should know all the names of those four chambers, know all the names of those valves. What's the purpose of a valve?
Keep the
blood flowing. Yeah, keep the blood flowing in one direction. Keep it from going retrograde. Keep it from flowing backwards because that will kill the heart when that happens. And how many sides does the heart have? How many sides? Two sides. What are the two sides? Okay. Okay. You saw apex base? Yeah, those are sides. But I'm thinking more in terms of function. What's the best way to think of function in terms of the heart and sides? What were you thinking? There is the right side and the left side. Right? So the left atrium works with the left ventricle. The right atrium works with the right ventricle. So what and how many circulations are in there in the body? There are two. That's right. So and what are those two circulations? Okay. I don't know if I like arterial, but I like systemic versus pulmonary circulation, right? So the right ventricle pumps blood into which of those circulations? That's on your slide right here. The right ventricle pumps blood through the pulmonary circulation, which is through the lungs, and the left ventricle pumps blood through the systemic circulation, which is pretty much everywhere in your body except the lungs. All right, so which ventricle has a harder job, the left ventricle or the right ventricle?
The left,
because it takes a lot more force to pump blood through the systemic circulation rather than the pulmonary circulation, because the pulmonary circulation is very short. It doesn't have as much resistance. All right? The blood flowing through the systemic circulation has to equal the amount of blood flowing through the pulmonary circulation. All right? So blood flows in a nice round circle. So therefore, the right ventricle has a really easy job. And when a muscle has a really easy job, what does it have a tendency to do?
Atrophy,
yeah, it just doesn't stay strong. So the right ventricle, when you look at it, is a lot thinner. It's about 30% the thickness of the left ventricle. The left ventricle is really powerful and strong because it has to develop much higher pressures to pump blood through the systemic circulation. Okay, so make sure you can trace a drop of blood through the circulation and know something about the state of oxygenation of that blood. So where does, let's talk about blood vessels. In this chapter, you should know that there are three kinds of blood vessels. And what do we call a blood vessel Or what's the definition for a vein? What does a vein do? Okay. Oh, I'm glad we're starting here. All right, so this is a new part. We haven't covered this topic yet.
Oh, taking blood to the heart.
Okay, so the definition of a vein is a blood vessel, and it carries blood. And the way that you know if it's an artery or a vein is by the direction of the blood flow with respect to the heart, not by what's contained in the blood, right? So if the blood flow is to the heart, it's going to be a vein. And some veins are high in oxygen, some veins are low in oxygen. And you just have to know which ones those are. What about an artery? It carries blood away from the heart. And again, there are some arteries that carry oxygen. There are some that are low in oxygen. All right, so then the third kind of blood vessel is symbolized by this network right here in the pulmonary circulation and this network here in the systemic circulation. What are those blood vessels called? They're neither arteries nor veins. Those are capillaries, and they have a very special function. Don't think about carrying blood to the heart or away from the heart. You should think of them as sites for exchange. Those are the only vessels where things can enter the blood or things can leave the blood. And in the next chapter, we'll see why that is. All right, so let's look at the vessels, the great vessels coming off the base of the heart. Remember, here's the apex, here's the base. And here we have capillaries in the lungs. All right, so what's the key term for capillaries? What's the function of a capillary?
Exchange.
Yeah, look at my cursor right there, exchange. So what's exchanging in the lungs? Gases are exchanging. What's going into the blood? Oxygen. What's leaving the blood?
CO2.
So in these lungs right here, oxygen is entering the blood, and therefore we give this blood a red color. So it means it's high in oxygen. And here is a vessel that's bringing blood back to the heart that's high in oxygen. All right. What do we call that, an artery or a vein?
Vein.
Okay, I heard both, artery and vein. All right, now this, and I purposely tried to be just a little confusing right here, because here's a blood vessel bringing blood back to the heart, so the definition of that kind of vessel is a vein. Since it's the pulmonary circulation, this vein just happens to be high in oxygen, because where is it coming back from? The lungs, right? That's the pulmonary circulation. All right, so then the pulmonary veins bring oxygenated blood back to the left atrium, passes the bicuspid valve into the left ventricle. Left ventricle then pumps blood past the aortic semilunar valve into the aorta, and this is the beginning of which circulation? What are the two circulations again? You got pulmonary and systemic. Which one is this? This is systemic. So these are the kinds of arteries you are familiar with because it's carrying what kind of blood? Oxygenated blood through to the whole body. Right, so this is what your basic understanding of what an artery is, carrying oxygenated blood, but that's only true in the systemic circulation. It gets to capillaries in your body. And what happens in these capillaries? Exchange once again. And what kind of exchange in the systemic circulation? CO2 goes in and oxygen goes out because your tissues need oxygen to stay alive. All right, so now the blood is high in CO2. Here is a vessel bringing blood back to the heart. What do we call a vessel bringing blood back to the heart? That's a vein. And this is now your common understanding is of these veins carry deoxygenated blood back to the heart. And these are what we call the vena cava, superior vena cava, inferior vena cava to the right atrium, past the tricuspid valve into the right ventricle. Right ventricle pumps deoxygenated blood past the pulmonary semilunar valve into the pulmonary artery. Now, what's strange about this pulmonary artery compared to other arteries in your body? It's deoxygenated, all right? But that's okay because where is it going? To the lungs to pick up oxygen, right? So from this slide, you should see that the heart has two sides, the left side and the right side, two circulations, the pulmonary versus the systemic, and the pulmonary circulation is exactly opposite in terms of function compared to the systemic circulation, right? Because in the systemic circulation, arteries are oxygenated, but in the pulmonary circulation, arteries are deoxygenated. And don't forget about what the function of the lung is. So if you get lost in thought, always just think, well, why is blood going to the lungs? To pick up oxygen and to release CO2, right? So the pulmonary circulation is opposite. All right, so that's a little bit of a discussion of the two important circulations. I do want to show you this nice exam figure right here. All right, so make sure you can label all these different parts of the heart. So again, the two inferior chambers are ventricles. They're separated by the interventricular septum. So septum just separates a cavity into two separate chambers. All right, all of these little muscles right here are what we call trabeculae carnae. Some of them look more like papillae, like your fingertip, for instance. And if they're connected to these little tendons, then these are what we call papillary muscles. Papillary muscles are always going to be connected to an atrioventricular valve, like I see here and over here, via these chordae tendini. And then, of course, in a lab practicum, be sure you know how to spell that real funky spelling for chordae tendini. All right, that's important. So here is the left atrium, and here is the right atrium. Between the atria and its corresponding ventricle, you have the atrioventricular valve. And there are two. Here's the tricuspid and bicuspid. How are you going to remember that the tricuspid is over here on the right side of the heart? Try before you buy, right? So it's pretty easy to remember. Another name for the bicuspid valve is the mitral valve. All right, so atrioventricular valves are prevented from inverting when the ventricles contract because they're connected to chordae tendini, which then are connected to these papillary muscles. The semilunar valves at the base of the pulmonary trunk and the base of the ascending aorta do not have chordae tendini. The structure of these valves are such that they don't invert. And there are three cusps to both of these semilunar valves right here. All right, we see some other auxiliary muscles in the atria. We call these pectinate muscles. So don't get trabeculae carnae with pectinate muscles confused. It's only by location, but both of those muscles give additional strength for contraction to the heart. All right, what else should I say about this? Oh, notice the wall thickness. How could you tell this is left ventricle compared to this ventricle over here? Because look at the thickness of the free wall of the left ventricle compared to the right ventricle. It's about three times thicker. All right, so the right ventricle pumps blood into which circulation? The pulmonary circulation. And the most anterior great vessel on the heart is the pulmonary trunk. That's the one that you see when you first start doing your dissection. It's big and thick, and it looks like the aorta, but it's not. It's the pulmonary trunk. In order to find the aorta, what do you have to do? You have to dissect deeper into the mediastinum to find the aorta. So the aorta is posterior to the pulmonary trunk, and here you see it right here. All right, the pulmonary trunk, let's go back to pulmonary trunk for just a little bit, bifurcates very early on into the left pulmonary artery. That's going to go to what lung? Left lung. Here is the right pulmonary artery. What lung does that go to? Right lung. Okay. Good, so that's all you have to know on this figure. So this part of the aorta is going from an inferior position on the base of the heart superiorly, so we call this the ascending aorta. And then here is the arch. It arches over the right pulmonary artery, and then it continues making a turn, and it descends down through the thorax into the abdominal cavity. So we would call this division, and if we were to see a little bit of it down over here, that would be the descending aorta. So those are some of the main branches of the aorta, the ascending, the arch, and the descending. There are some arteries that come off the ascending aorta, which we're going to get to in just a second. So those are the first branches. Then there are some subsequent branches that come off the arch of the aorta. And on your test, I want you to know what these are, even though we haven't gotten to blood vessels yet. So I want you to modify this figure in case I ask you on the test. All right, so what part of the aorta is this right here? That's the arch. the first branch off the arch, not the first branch off the aorta, but the first branch off the arch is this one right here. And that is the brachiocephalic artery. Okay, brachio means going to the arm, yeah, or brachium, and cephalic means going to the head. So this is a branch that takes blood to both the right arm and right side of the head. Then these two do the job of the brachiocephalic. So this is the left common carotid going to the left side of the head, and this is the left subclavian going to the left arm. So you see that we lose a little symmetry right here in terms of structure, but not in terms of function. Right? So the left common carotid, left the left subclavian do the job of the brachiocephalic. And in humans, we only have one brachiocephalic artery. There are some animals that don't even have any brachiocephalic. There are some animals have two brachiocephalics. Okay. What else about this diagram? I don't know. I think we're doing pretty good with labeling all this stuff. Anybody have any confusion with this slide right here? Yeah. The left subclavian, all right, it means that it goes underneath the clavicle as it's coursing into your axilla and then finally into your brachium and indeed your whole left upper appendage. Okay, so it goes to your left arm, basically. Okay, and so that's why they call it subclavian, because it goes right underneath the clavicle. Yeah. Okay, any other questions? Oh, there's something here, fossovallus. There is a hole right here. That's actually a depression in us, but there is a hole in a fetus that allows blood to go from the right atrium directly into the left atrium. Now, can you think, what circulation is being bypassed if blood goes from the right atrium into the left atrium directly? It's bypassing the pulmonary circulation, because when a person's in utero, are they using their lungs? No, there's no oxygen in the lungs, so it's very futile. It's a waste of energy to pump blood through the lungs because there's no oxygen there to pick up anyway. All right, where does blood get oxygenated in the fetus? It's in the placenta. Yeah, it's in the placenta. So that's a different kind of circulation, which maybe you looked at in lab. But when you're born, this foraminal valley closes over and just becomes a depression that we call the fossa ovalis. All right, so that's the only other thing on this diagram that I didn't mention. Okay, and we're going to talk about some layers of the heart, maybe right now. Let's see. Yeah, okay, let's talk about some layers of the heart. All right, remember there were layers in bone. What were the layers in bone? What's the most superficial layer in bone? Yeah, the periosteum. What's the deepest layer? The endosteum. Okay. Well, the heart sort of is like that, except it's a serous membrane. Okay, so what can you tell me about a serous membrane? Going way, way back, how many serous membranes did we look at? We looked at the peritoneum. Okay, we looked at the pleural membrane. And a serous membrane always has three main divisions to it. Three main divisions. Oh, goodness, do I have a marker here? Okay. So, here we got somebody. All right, and let's just say here is their abdominal cavity. All right, so here is a muscle wall. And then here we have some organs, like a stomach. Okay. And so here is one part of the membrane. Here's another part of the membrane. So I'll label this 1, 2, and then there's a space between this membrane here and this membrane there. All right, this is for a serous membrane. What's the definition of a serous membrane? Any kind of membrane lines a cavity or covers a surface, or maybe it's doing both at the same time. Remember the two kinds of membranes, mucous membrane versus serous membrane. A mucous membrane lines what kind of cavity? A cavity that's open to the outside world, like your digestive tract, your respiratory tract, right? Oral cavity, reproductive tract. But a serous membrane lines a cavity that's not open to the outside world. And a serous membrane has got three parts. One, the part that is right on the surface of the organ, right here, is what we call the, and since this is the peritoneal cavity, this would be the visceral peritoneum. Okay, and then number three is lining the body cavity, which is the peritoneal cavity. That would be the parietal peritoneum. And then what would number three be? What would you call number three? This right here, this is that space between number one and number two. Oh, wait a second. I was thinking ahead, two. Let's put it up here. Parietal peritoneum. And then number three would be what? The serous cavity. And we would call that the peritoneal cavity. And what's it filled with? Serous fluid, right? So that means that all of your intestines can be squishing around in there, doing their job, moving around. All right, so three divisions, visceral peritoneum, parietal peritoneum, and the serous cavity filled with serous fluid. Well, what cavity is the heart in? It's, of course, in the thoracic cavity, but there's a smaller cavity. It's in the mediastinum, but it's even in a smaller, there's a subcavity of the mediastinum even. There's the pericardial cavity. Yeah, pericardial cavity. And is the pericardial cavity open to the outside world? Absolutely not. All right, so is it a mucous membrane or a serous membrane? It's a serous membrane. So it's got to have these three parts to it. All right, so here we have a really nice picture of the heart. All right, let me zoom in. Here's a nice picture of the heart, and then let's zoom in to this part of the left atrium right here. All right, so here we see the left atrium, and this is the atrial chamber. Right, so here's the atrial chamber down over here. Oh, look at these muscles. What do we call these little muscles in an atrium? Those are little pectinate muscles. And then covering every surface, every little nook and cranny of the inside of the heart chamber, there's a membrane associated with that, just like the endosteum. So that's what we would call the endocardium, right? So the deepest layer of this, the deepest layer on the heart is what we call the endocardium. And the endocardium is special because it's smooth and slippery, so blood can flow over the endocardium very quickly. And since it's smooth and slippery, that means that the blood won't clot. It will prevent the blood from clotting, which is really a fantastic thing. Because what would happen if you have a blood clot floating around in your circulation caused by a rough surface on the heart? Could go to the brain, kill that part of the brain. What would we call that?
Stroke.
It could go to the heart and kill a part of the heart. That's what we call a heart attack. Right? So a brain attack and a heart attack really pretty much are the same kind of thing in that regard. All right. This layer of the heart right here contains the myocytes that contract, so we call this myocardium. And then the layer that makes up, that touches the surface of the heart, we call this the epicardium. So the three layers that make up the wall of the heart from deep to superficial would be endocardium, myocardium, and epicardium. Okay? Or if you want to talk about it from superficial to deep, it would be what? Epicardium, myocardium, and endocardium. Furthermore, this epicardium right here is part of the pericardial cavity, part of the pericardial membrane, the serous membrane that surrounds the heart. So it has two functions, right? It's a part of the wall of the myocardium, but it also makes the serous membrane up. So what do we call the serous membrane that's right on the surface of an organ inside of a cavity? Visceral, right? And since this is the pericardial cavity, this tissue right here also goes by the name of visceral pericardium. But since it's right on the surface of the heart, what else is it called? Epicardium. So epicardium and visceral pericardium are exactly the same layer. Okay? It has different names depending on whether you're thinking about the wall thickness, or if you're thinking about the membranes that hold the heart in place, the pericardial membranes. Okay? So it all depends on your point of view. So that visceral pericardium, right, is continuous with the membrane that is right on this, that forms the surface of the pericardial cavity. What do we call the superficial part of a serous membrane? That's the parietal division, right? So here's the parietal layer of the pericardial serous membrane. And what do we have in between? That's the pericardial cavity filled with serous fluid. All right, so that just allows the heart to beat around inside your chest, actually fairly violently, right? But it gives it enough support to where it's not going to jump outside your chest or end up in your abdominal cavity. But it holds it in place, and it reduces friction so that you don't have inflammation of this area. All right. Now, the serous membrane is not really strong enough to hold the heart in place, so there is an additional, more fibrous part of the pericardial membrane that suspends the heart, and we call this the fibrous pericardium. All right, so we have a number of different membranes. We've got the fibrous pericardium, the parietal division of the serous membrane, serous fluid in the pericardial cavity, and then the visceral pericardium. Sometimes this system of membranes and this pericardial cavity does get inflamed, maybe due to infection, for instance, or trauma after surgery. All right, what do we call that? That's pericarditis, and it fills up with fluid. So instead of being about 1 centimeter, maybe it fills up to maybe 3 centimeters or 4 centimeters in fluid right here. All right, and as the pericardial cavity inflates, what happens to the heart itself? It gets squished down. Okay? So again, what's the job of the heart? It's to pump blood. And if it gets squished down because of pericarditis, blood can't flow into the heart. And when blood doesn't flow into the heart, when the heart contracts, how much blood is it pumping? Not very much at all. Right? So that's a very dangerous situation. And that has to be dealt with. You got to find the cause of that. But immediately what you have to do is remove that fluid. Fast. How would you move fluid out of the pericardial cavity fast? Yeah, you just aspirate it out with a nice hypodermic needle, right? Jab it in there, suck it out, and your patients will be really happy that you did that, believe it or not. Okay. All right, so that's the membranes of the wall, the layers of the wall, as well as the pericardial membranes around the pericardium. All right, so you need a couple different points of view to understand that. So we talked about the transmural layers as well as the pericardial membrane. They're all associated with each other. Okay, we kind of talked about this already. I think there was one thing that I didn't mention, and that is the heart performs its job. It pumps blood in a cyclic fashion. It's not like an electric motor. Maybe some of you have an electric toothbrush at home, and when you turn it on, okay, it just goes buzz, 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 and does its job all the time until you turn it off. Okay, but the heart doesn't work that way. It works on a cycle where at some points of the cycle it's contracting, pumping blood, and at other parts of the cycle it's relaxing, filling up with blood. So the cycle has two main parts. What are those two main parts again? Those are the circulatory. But in terms of function of the heart, in terms of the heart cycle, part of it is pumping, part of it is relaxing. Okay, so pumping, contracting is pumping blood out, relaxing is filling with blood, right? One follows the other, but we give them special names. When the heart is pumping, all right, pumping blood out, when it's contracting, we call that systole. We call that systole. And when the heart is relaxing, filling with blood, we call that diastole. Guess what happens to your blood pressure during diastole when the heart is relaxed and filling with blood? Guess what happens to your blood pressure? Does it stay the same? Does it go up or does it decrease? It actually has to decrease. So your blood pressure decreases and decreases and decreases, and it would go to zero, but what happens before it gets there? Your heart pumps again, and it goes way back up to peak systolic pressure. So when we measure pressure in some people, or well, in everybody, hopefully everybody's got their blood pressure measured in here. How many numbers are you given? You're given two numbers corresponding to the peak contraction, which is what we call systolic pressure, and then you're also given your lowest blood pressure at the end of diastole, when the heart is relaxed. And so your heart, your blood pressure is always reported as those two numbers, systolic pressure over diastolic pressure.
So,
Oh, when the heart is relaxed, the only reason why you have blood pressure is because the heart is contracting and pumping blood out. So that boosts your blood pressure up. And then when your heart relaxes, your blood pressure starts to fall away. And indeed, it would go all the way to zero. But before it gets there, what happens to your heart? It contracts again. Okay, so your blood pressure is going up and down, up and down. I'm glad you're interested in this because this is not just anatomy. What is this? This is physiology. So if here is zero, usually we measure blood pressure in millimeters of mercury. And let's just say that this is 120. Okay, and this is about 60. That's about half the way up. This is what your blood pressure should look like. All right, so let's just say this is 80 right here. When the heart contracts, all right, and then it goes back down. And it would continue to go down to zero, but what happens? The heart contracts again, and then it goes down. All right, so this is what we call diastolic pressure. This would be systolic pressure. And so when you're given two numbers, what does that look like? 120 over 80. And that would be a normal blood pressure. If any of these numbers are higher than 120 over 80, what do we call that? That's a disease process. That's hypertension, and it's deadly, right? But it's not noticeable by the individual, and so that's why everybody should get their blood pressure checked. And that's a nice test. You get your blood pressure tested every time you go see a doctor. Even in dental offices now, they check your blood pressure because it's such an important measurement to have, and it just saves so many lives if you control your blood pressure, okay? And if you don't control your blood pressure, what's going to happen? You're going to die, okay? Basically, just as simple as that. So hopefully your blood pressure didn't skyrocket when you hear that. So it is sometimes a little bit difficult to treat. Okay. All right, coronary circulation. Let's see what I can find for coronary circulation. All right, so when you get started looking at hearts in lab, the three things that you should automatically find, which are easy to find, would be number one, the tip of the heart, which is what we call the apex. Okay, and then we're going to find the base. And then you find this diagonal stripe on the surface of the heart, and we call that the anterior longitudinal sulcus. Anterior longitudinal sulcus. So what side of the heart is that? That is the anterior side, because we call it the anterior longitudinal sulcus. And this anterior sulcus you can see from across the room. So that's going to be really easy to see. All right, so on this side of the anterior longitudinal sulcus is the left side of the heart, and on the other side is the right side of the heart. And indeed, this is the right ventricle because it's pumping blood into the pulmonary trunk, right, which is the most anterior great vessel on the heart. So here we got the right atrium, left atrium, right ventricle, left ventricle over here. Now, since the heart is a muscle pump, it needs blood and oxygen to stay alive, just like any other part of your body does. And it has its own vascular system, which we call coronary vessels. Right? Coronary arteries, part of the systemic circulation, bring oxygen to the heart. And there are two. This one is what we call the left coronary. This one over here is what we call the right coronary artery. And these originate from the ascending aorta, right within the cusps of the aortic semilunar valve. So they're very close to the root of the aorta. Kind of difficult to see. All right, the left coronary bifurcates very early on into the circumflex, which comes over here, and this descending branch. Sometimes we call this the left anterior descending branch. Sometimes it's called, like in your book over here, the anterior interventricular artery. So it's got a number of different names. And of course, you can use any name you wish as long as you can provide a good reference, right, from some reputable source. But usually it's called the LAD. What does LAD stand for? Left anterior descending. Okay? But this is where you find the interventricular septum, so sometimes it's called the anterior interventricular artery. Okay, the right coronary, which we see right here, all right, bifurcates into this marginal artery right here. And we're going to have to look around to the posterior side of the heart. Okay, so here we see the circumflex coming around. We see the right coronary coming around. Here's the posterior interventricular artery. And so that's pretty good for arteries. But in the sulcus between the atria and the ventricles, not only do you have the right coronary and the circumflex, you also have some important veins, right? Like the great cardiac vein. This is draining blood back to the heart, right? That's the definition of a vein. Here's the posterior vein. And here we have the middle cardiac vein. So the middle cardiac vein, the posterior vein, and the great cardiac vein all empty blood into this vessel right here. This is kind of analogous to the superior vena cava and inferior vena cava. It is huge. But we call this the coronary sinus. So a sinus can have various things in it, maybe air, depending on exactly what anatomy we're talking about, right? Like the paranasal sinuses just have lymphatic tissue and air. But the coronary sinus is a huge vein that's bringing blood back to the, what chamber is this right here? Right atrium from the coronary circulation. Yeah, question. Somebody had a question. Cardiac vein, posterior vein, and the middle cardiac vein. Those are good. I don't want to go into any other detail, I don't think. Yeah. Yeah. Just those. There are other things that return blood back to the right atrium, but beyond the scope of this course. Okay. That's good if you were to know that. All right, so I know we spent a lot of time with the skeletal system, which is the framework for our body, provides support, motion, and things like that. Well, the heart does have a skeletal system as well, but it's not made out of bone. It's made out of dense, regular connective tissue. What is the compound? What is the thing in the matrix of dense, regular connective tissue that gives that tissue its strength? What's the chemical compound? Collagen. Yeah, it's collagen, as opposed to hydroxyapatite, which is what one of the compounds you would find in bone, for instance. Okay, the fibrous skeleton performs a number of functions for the heart. Let me see if I can find the fibrous skeleton here someplace. Here. Okay, so we're looking down from the base of the heart inferiorly. The atria have been dissected away, and as a matter of fact, I don't see any ventricles either because they're below this level. So we're looking right through the base of the heart. This is the fibrous skeleton of the heart. So it's like a cap between the atria and the ventricles right here. And it has a lot of collagen. It's very tough and strong. And in this area right here, this is where all the valves originate, right, in the fibrous skeleton. So all the valves of the heart are connected to this very tough cap between the atria and the ventricles. All right, so that makes it very easy, for instance, if somebody has a defective valve, right, and say, for instance, this tricuspid valve needs to be replaced, guess what? It's very easy to excise it and sew the new valve right into the fibrous skeleton of the heart, because it's what? It's tough, right? It's even tougher than dermis, right? So that's really nice. So the fibrous skeleton helps position the valve so they don't move around, and they can withstand a lot of pressure or force when they do their job. All right, so the fibrous skeleton anchors the valves in position. The fibrous skeleton is also, since it's dense regular connective tissue, it's not muscle tissue, it separates the atria electrically from the ventricle. So electrical impulses can't go directly from an atrium into the ventricle. We're going to see why that's important in just a little bit. Oh, yeah, so the fibrous skeleton also prevents overdilation of the valve openings. That's a good point. Because what were to happen if this tricuspid valve all of a sudden started to dilate? If it got bigger and bigger and bigger. What makes up the tricuspid valve? It's kind of circular, but it has the valve cusps. All right, and we can model the cusps like my fingertips coming off my hand, right? And in order for that valve to work, what about the fingertips on my right and left hand? They have to touch each other in order to close. But if the valve starts to dilate, get bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger, what happens to the valve leaflets? They can't touch each other, and then there's going to be a big hole in the valve, and then will it function as a valve anymore? It won't function as a valve. Right, so that's another really important function of the fibrous skeleton of the heart. It maintains the integrity of these valves so that they can continue to work as valves and not leak. All right, that takes us to the conduction system of the heart. All right, so the heart, aside from the fibrous skeleton, is made out of muscle tissue. And only muscle tissue. But the heart is kind of strange. If we were to take any mammal, including a person, a human being, and excise their heart, all right, and put it on the table, guess what's going to happen to that heart? Is it just going to sit there? Just like Raiders of the Lost Ark, what's going to happen? It's actually going to contract. All right, so the heart does not need innervation to contract. You do have nerves that go to the heart, but the nerves only adjust the rate and force of contraction. Nerves can speed up the rate, all right, and force of contraction, or it can slow the heart down. But the heart by itself has its own autorhythmic function. It will contract by itself. And the reason is because of the special nodal tissues that we find in heart. The nodal tissue is shown in yellow. How did I do? Yellow. And the myocardium, the contractile cells, are shown in, oh, I don't know what that is, brown, red, maroon, peach, okay. Okay, so the contractile cells have this peachy color, right, and this yellow color right here are specialized muscle cells. All right, so these muscle cells don't contract, but they transmit electrical information almost like a nerve does. So that's something you can look forward to in a physiology class. You'll notice in a physiology class a lot of similarity between muscle tissue and nerve tissue. All right? So this nodal tissue is really specialized to conduct electrical information through the heart. That electrical information is a signal for the heart to contract. Without that electrical signal, the heart won't contract. All right, so right at the junction of the superior vena cava, on the roof of the right atrium, there is some special nodal tissue that acts as the pacemaker. This controls the rhythm of the heart, how fast it will contract. And we call this the sinoatrial node. So the SA node is what we call the pacemaker. This generates an electrical signal. And that electrical signal can spread through the whole right atrium, and it can spread through the interatrial septum into the left atrium. And that signal then is going to cause the atria to contract. That electrical signal can't just jump into the ventricles. What's preventing the transfer of that electrical signal from the atria into these ventricles right here? The fibrous skeleton, right? It can't get through there, except that there is one special pathway that it can get into the left into the ventricles. Here's what we call the atrioventricular node, or AV node. This receives electrical signals from the SA node, and they're held there for a short period of time. It delays the signal, and then it sends that electrical signal through the AV bundle, or atrioventricular bundle, that passes right through. Where is it passing right through? It's passing right through the fibrous skeleton of the heart. So here is like a special wire that pierces the fibrous skeleton of the heart, injecting electrical signals into the ventricles. All right, so that's the job of the AV bundle. Sometimes we call that the bundle of His. So this acts as a wire or a bridge that's going to coordinate electrical signals in the atria and the ventricles. All right, then the electrical signals move into the bundle branches, and it moves down the bundle branches very rapidly, all the way down to, what part of the heart is this down here?
Apex.
The apex. Electrical signals reach the apex of the ventricles first, and then those electrical signals get spread out into the muscle cells via these little fibers, which we call Purkinje fibers. Purkinje fibers cause electrical stimulation of the muscle cells of the heart, and then that causes those cells to contract. The electrical signal then proceeds up the free wall of the ventricles, moving back up toward the base, causing these muscles to contract, and then these muscles up here to contract. So you see that there's a special pattern of contraction of the ventricles, or actually of the whole heart. So what contracts first? The atria contract first, because that's where the pacemaker is. These contract, pumping blood into the ventricles. It helps fill the ventricles up. And then the ventricles contract after the atria contract, starting with what region? The basal region or the apical region? Remember, these electrical signals travel very fast down through the bundle branches, down into the apex. So it causes the apex to contract first, and when these contract first, which way is it forcing blood? It's forcing blood up, which is where the great arteries are. That's where the pulmonary artery and where the aorta is behind it. Right? So the basilar regions of the ventricles don't contract first, because if that were to happen, which way would blood be pumped? It would be forced down into the apex, and when it would get to the apex, where would it go? No place. It would be trapped. Right, so the apex contracts first, pumping blood up out of the heart. And that's due to this special conduction system. All right, so you should know the sequence. SA node, and then it goes to the AV node, where it's delayed. That allows the atria to contract and pump blood into the ventricles. The AV node then sends signals into the AV bundle, or bundle of His, where it goes then very rapidly down to the apex, and then that causes the apex to contract, and then the more superior sections of the free wall of the myocardium to contract, pumping blood out of the heart. Okay, so the types of nodal tissue that directly stimulate the muscle cells are what we call Purkinje fibers. But remember, all of these tissues right here, the conduction system, are not nerve fibers. They're actually specialized muscle cells that are specialized to do that job. Let me see what kind of picture I have. I don't have any pictures of ECGs. Oh well, you'll have to take a physiology class. All right, well, let's look at this heart right here. So here is the superior vena cava right atrium. This region right here is where we have the SA node. And what can you tell me about the SA node? What is it functioning as?
Pacemaker.
It's the pacemaker of the heart. So it sends electrical stimulation over the right atrium and left atrium, right? Because those electrical signals can hop from one cell to another. And that's going to cause what happen in these atria? It's going to cause contraction. So the atria contract first. Now that electrical signal doesn't just jump automatically into the ventricle. It has to be picked up by some special tissue. What do we call that special little node? The AV node, right? Which then sends the signal via the AV bundle into the ventricle and then down the bundle branches through the ventricular septum, so the apex starts to contract first. Well, you know what? Some people maybe get a heart attack right at that AV node and it dies, right? So guess what happens then? Guess what? And maybe the AV bundle dies. And what is that? That's a way for what to happen? For electrical signals to get from the atria into the ventricles. And when those cells die, that pathway is gone, right? So then after that, the atria contract according to their own rhythm, and the ventricles contract according to their own rhythm. They're no longer coordinated. All right, that sounds really dangerous. It's not too terribly dangerous, but that certainly can happen when there's damage to the AV node or AV bundle. That's interesting to see that on an ECG. And what is that called? That's a heart block. Okay. So what is that called? Yeah, it's a heart block. Is that what you were asking? Like that or what? Oh, okay. Let's talk about some other pathology in the heart since we have just a little bit of time. But that would be a heart block when the electrical signal can't get from the atria into the ventricles. And you'll have like two different heartbeats, and that might feel a little strange. All right, but there's another condition that feels even stranger. All right, so the atria contract, both atria contract together due to that electrical signal. But every once in a while, instead of the signal originating at the pacemaker, all right, spreading nice uniformly over the right and left atria, sometimes, right, it might start in the SA node, get down over here, and then maybe bounce around and follow different routes, and then get over into the left atrium and follow different routes, okay, and kind of just snake its way around the surface of the atrium, okay. And as it's snaking around, guess what it's doing? That electrical signal is a signal for contraction. So instead of the atria beating together like this, what are the atria doing? The electrical signal is snaking around over the surface of the atria. The atria are partially contracting, just kind of wiggling around, all right, but not pumping. They're just kind of wiggling around like this. We call that fibrillation. Okay, that's fibrillation. And when the heart is fibrillating, it's not pumping blood. And that's really sort of dangerous in these atria. It's not immediately fatal, because what can you tell me about the thickness of an atrium? Is it as thick as the left ventricle? No. Is it as thick as the right ventricle? Not even. It's almost paper thin. So the job of the atria in everyday life is not very important. They hardly pump any blood into the ventricles at all. So if they fibrillate, it's not going to hurt or kill somebody immediately, because they don't really do much job in pumping. But blood still can stagnate. It can pool in the atria when they're fibrillating. All right, and when blood pools, guess what it has a tendency to do? It has a tendency to change from a fluid to a solid, so it turns into a clot. Well, where's one of the last places you would like to have a blood clot? Inside your heart, right? So atrial fibrillation inherently is very dangerous, because it can generate blood clots in your circulatory system. So therefore, it has to be treated. And sometimes it can be treated pharmacologically with drugs very nicely. At other times, that rhythm has to be converted into what we call a normal sinus rhythm, where the atria contract. How do you see this in movies all the time? How do you convert somebody from fibrillation, or maybe when a heart isn't beating at all, back to a normal rhythm? Yeah, just like the normal heart uses electricity, we can take electricity and shock the heart, all right? And when you shock the heart, what happens to the heart? It just contracts, right? There's so much electricity, the whole heart contracts, and then hopefully the whole heart relaxes again and it goes back to its normal rhythm. So we call that cardioversion. But when somebody has atrial fibrillation, it's not really serious. They feel their heart is acting funny, but you're still conscious. And when you get shocked, guess what? You're still conscious. So it's actually kind of a gruesome thing to do to somebody, but it's much better than having them generate blood clots. And sometimes in an emergency room, if you ever hear anybody screaming, one of the reasons is maybe the first time they got cardioverted because they have atrial fibrillation, it didn't work. So what do you have to do then? Do it again. And if it doesn't work again, you have to keep trying, all right? And after the first time the patient catches on, it's not a very pleasant experience, all right? But that's important to make sure blood is flowing through these atria right here. Now, that same thing can happen to the ventricles. That electrical information, if there's damage to the conduction system of the heart, so instead of flowing down the bundle branches up the Purkinje fibers, if it starts to travel around the heart in these wormy patterns or circular routes, right, the ventricles themselves are going to go into fibrillation, right? And when the ventricles are fibrillating, they're not pumping. Now that's a really serious condition, because how long can you live for if your heart's in fibrillation? Okay, well, I think maybe we talked about this. There's an important chemical that's an energy supply all over your body. What is that energy molecule? That's ATP. Did we talk about ATP in this class? Maybe just a little bit we talked about ATP. Well, you need oxygen to make that ATP, and when there's no blood flow through your body, there's no oxygen, those tissues can't make ATP and they start to die. So how long can you maintain consciousness without oxygen going to your brain? Because your brain uses up ATP so fast. What period of time can you maintain consciousness without oxygen going to your brain? Okay, I think maybe we talked about this, maybe not. It's 3 seconds. So when blood supply is cut off from your brain, 3 seconds, you lose consciousness. So when your heart goes into fibrillation, you have just seconds of consciousness. And if blood isn't restored going to your brain, what's going to happen to the brain? It's going to die. And when does your brain die? After what period of time? 3 minutes. That's ballpark information, right? So 3 seconds, you're unconscious. 3 minutes, you're dead. So ventricular fibrillation is extremely serious because 3 seconds, that person is unconscious, and 3 minutes, they're dead. So that's why a lot of places, like even Disneyland, have what? Automatic electronic defibrillators, where you can actually put paddles on somebody's chest and the machine is smart. It can tell if the heart's in fibrillation or not, and if it is, it says probably stand back, and it shocks the person that's unconscious. Okay, we don't have any here on campus, but the fire station on Holder is, you know, a couple hundred yards away. Those guys have all kinds of defibrillators, so you just call 911 and they would probably be here within 3 minutes, which is really nice. Okay, how else can you help somebody if you don't have an electronic defibrillator?
CPR.
Is anybody certified in here CPR? That's really good, because somebody that's trained in CPR, they're trained on how to assist somebody's heartbeat whose heart is not beating by themselves. And what would you do for somebody whose heart is not beating by themselves? What would you do? That would be chest compressions, right? You just push down on their heart, and the pressure of blood inside their heart would increase, but it would only flow in the right direction through the heart. Why? Because the valves would still be working, so blood would flow from the heart into the arteries and then into veins, back into the heart, and you compress the heart again, and that would force blood into the arteries again because of those valves. All right, so that's a really nice technique to know. So that's atrial fibrillation, ventricular fibrillation, and you got to find out exactly why that's happening, right? So it just doesn't happen all the time. There's probably a number of people that have defibrillators implanted in their thorax. There's a real famous guy that has a defibrillator because his heart goes into fibrillation all the time, which means he would be dying all the time. But you can only die one time, so that wouldn't be so exciting. But with that defibrillator, right, you can like go into fibrillation all the time and not worry too much. Who is that? Who's the vice president? And it's with Bush, and that was Dick Cheney. Has a lot of heart disease. And he's got an automatic electronic defibrillator all the time in his chest. Okay. All right, so we said that, does the heart need innervation to contract? What controls, what tells the heart to contract? Is it a nerve? It is the SA node, right? It's the pacemaker of the heart. But we said that there are nerves that can adjust the rhythm of the SA node. So would you think that would be a somatic nerve or an autonomic nerve going to the heart? Somebody said autonomic. That's really nice, because somatic goes where? Voluntary muscles, like skeletal muscles, that's it. So autonomic nerves go to cardiac muscles, smooth muscle, and gland. So there are autonomic nerves that go to the heart. And what can you tell me about the autonomic nervous system? It's based on antagonism. So how many divisions are there? There's two. There's one division that's going to be excitatory. There's going to be another division that is inhibitory. Right, and because of that antagonism, your body has precise control and balance over the heart. All right, so the two divisions are the parasympathetic versus the sympathetic. All right, the parasympathetic goes to the SA node and AB node. These adjust the heart rate. So we call that a chronotropic effect. What's a chronometer? What's a chronometer or a chronograph? Chrono means time. Right, so chronotropic effect means that it can just adjust the heart rate or rhythm. All right, and the most important nerve that goes to the heart, which comes from the cardioinhibitory center, which means that it slows the heart rate down, is the vagus nerve. Who can tell me something about the vagus nerve? It's number 10. Number 10 of what? Cranial nerve. Right. It's a cranial nerve. And number 10 in particular, right, X, that's the vagus nerve. And so it slows the heart rate down. All right. So if parasympathetic slows the heart rate down, what could you tell me about the sympathetic? It speeds it up, right? So it comes from the cardioacceleratory center in the medulla via thoracic outflow. Remember, parasympathetic outflow is cranial sacral. Sympathetic outflow is thoracolumbar, so it leads through the thoracic outflow. It's got to go through the sympathetic chain and ganglia, then to a sympathetic nerve to the heart. And sympathetic nerves go to the SA node and AV node for chronotropic effects, meaning it speeds the heart up. It's a positive chronotropic effect. But sympathetic nerves also go to the ventricles, where they stimulate force of contraction. All right, so sympathetic nerves increase the rate, but also the force of contraction. So if you've ever been driving down the 405 and all of a sudden an accident starts to happen around you with some big semi-tractor trucks and it looks like you're going to get squished to a pancake and die, all right, and you're sure you're going to die, what happens? What happens to your heart? It speeds up, but that's not the only thing. What else? It's like pounding outside your chest because the force of contraction increases. So the speed and force of contraction both increase due to increased sympathetic activity of these nerves, but also from epinephrine and norepinephrine from the adrenal medulla that get released as a result of that. So since the adrenal medulla releases all of that epinephrine in the blood, that has a long-lasting effect on you, right? It might be hours, for instance. All right, that's the effect. So sympathetic nerve effect would be very short-lived, but epinephrine from the adrenal medulla gland can last for hours in somebody because it's acting more like a hormone. Okay, so those are the two divisions. And I think that's it for the heart, unless somebody's got a question. Any questions on the heart? Let's go over the blood flow again. How about if we make a list? So we make a list and then try to put a picture in your mind, right? And if you want to do both at the same time, maybe you could draw a picture of the heart But let's just make a list. So let's trace a drop of blood through the circulation. Where should we start? The heart. Where in the heart? Let's trace a drop of blood and follow through this, the whole heart, whole circulation and everything. Who wants to start someplace? Pulmonary artery. Okay, pulmonary artery. Pulmonary artery. What kind of blood is in the pulmonary artery? Oxygenated or deoxygenated? Look, don't forget, that's an artery.
Deoxygenated.
Raise your hand if you say deoxygenated. Okay? Raise your hand if you say oxygenated. Nobody. That's good. That might be worth some points because pulmonary artery is taking blood away from the heart to where? The lungs to pick up oxygen. So let's put deox right here. All right, deoxygenated. All right, even though it's an artery, since it's pulmonary circulation, it's deoxygenated. All right, so it's in the pulmonary artery. Where is it going to go to next?
Lungs.
And what kind of blood vessels are in the lungs? Capillaries. Okay, and what happens in a capillary? Special function. Exchange. All right, exchange. So, let's see. O2 goes in. CO2 goes out. That's exchange. All right, after the capillaries, what blood vessel does it go to? I like it. Pulmonary. I heard pulmonary artery, pulmonary vein, but it's going from the lungs back to the heart. Okay, a little mind teaser right here. Pulmonary veins. All right, what's the state of the blood? I'm going to put oxy, standing for oxygenated blood. Even though it's a vein, but it's a pulmonary vein, right? All right, so after the pulmonary vein, where does it go to? What part of the heart does it go to? It goes to an atrium. Which one? Left atrium. What's the state of the blood in the left atrium? Oxygenated. From the left atrium, where does it go? It's got to pass a valve, right? An atrioventricular valve on the left side of the heart is the bicuspid. I'm going to put AV valve. What's the state of the blood? Oxygenated. After the bicuspid valve, left ventricle, oxygenated. Left ventricle, where does blood go? Okay, it's got to go into a vessel, but before it gets to that vessel, it has to pass through the aortic semilunar valve. And what's the state of the blood? Oxygenated. And then past the semilunar valve, it goes into the aorta. And is that an artery or a vein? That's an artery. And what's the state of blood? Oxygenated. All right, so let's come from there up to right here. After the aorta, what do we got? We got more capillaries. And in particular, which one? Systemic capillaries. What happens in capillaries? Exchange. What happens? O2 out. CO2 in, and after the systemic capillaries, what do we got? Yeah, we'll just say vena cava. And those are what? The inferior and superior vena cava. What's the state of the blood here? So we're going to say relatively low in oxygen. It's not completely deoxygenated. It's just lower in oxygen. Right, it's deoxygenated, and then do we get to the heart? Yes, we do. And it would be the right atrium. What's the state of the blood? deoxygenated. Right atrium, blood is going to pump into the right ventricle, but it's got to pass the tricuspid valve. Tricuspid AV valve, deoxygenated into the, oh, wait a second. Oh, yeah, okay, tricuspid, right, I was thinking about another class, right ventricle. What kind of blood's in the right ventricle? Deoxygenated. Right ventricle. We're going to get into the pulmonary artery after we pass what? Pulmonary semilunar valve. Okay, so that's still deoxygenated, goes to the pulmonary artery, deoxygenated, goes to the lungs, picks up oxygen, and this keeps going around and around and around like that. So if you can make a list just thinking of the structures in your mind, that's great, but if you're not there yet, maybe you need to draw a picture of the heart and the vessels and use that picture to help you make that list up a couple times until you can see it. Okay? All right, so then that's it for today. So next time, don't forget, you need a Scantron, a good eraser, no, an excellent eraser, your pencil, and I don't think you need a calculator or anything like that. Okay, question, yeah. Sign-in sheet, who's got the sign-in sheet? Go ahead. Yeah. Oh, when somebody gets a pacemaker, what's that? A pacemaker will take over the job of the SA node when the person's SA node isn't working really well. So remember, the SA node is the trigger for the heart to beat. So good candidates for a pacemaker is when their heartbeat is too slow. So when their heart fails to contract fast enough, so they might lose blood pressure, they might feel a little woozy or something, or even pass out. So somebody will get a pacemaker that can diagnose that, and then it will gently shock the heart, increasing the heart rate, and so then they don't have low blood pressure and feel faint or pass out. So a pacemaker won't help for somebody whose heart rate is too fast, but it will help somebody whose heart rate is too slow. Yeah. You know somebody with a pacemaker? They're pretty common. Yeah, it seems, yeah. It's because their heart rate is normally too slow. It doesn't know how to speed up for some reason. So there's too much vagal influence or not enough sympathetic influence on the heart. Or maybe both. I'm not sure. Okay.